Episode 8, The Good and the Evil. Lucy Westenray has died, the first victim of Count Dracula since his arrival in England. Only Dr. Van Helsing realizes that Miss Lucy is not dead, but undead, an unwilling disciple of the vampire.
The funeral was arranged for the next succeeding day so that Lucy and her mother might be buried together. I attended to all the ghastly formalities, even as the urbane undertaker and his staff went about their business with that rare obsequious suaveté inherent to those of his vocation. Van Helsing and I took it upon ourselves to examine papers and so forth. He insisted upon looking over Lucy's papers himself.
When you find anything of the solicitor who is for the late Mrs. Westenray, seal all her papers and write him tonight. Should you discover any writings of Miss Lucy, hold them for me. It is not well that her very thoughts go into the hands of strangers. Now, I must search for what may be in the room of Miss Lucy.
I went on with my part of the work, and in another half hour had found the name and address of Mrs. Westenray's solicitor, and had written to him. All the poor lady's papers were in order. Explicit directions regarding the place of burial were given. I had hardly sealed the letter when Van Helsing walked in the room, saying,
"Can I help you, friend John? I am free, and if I may, my services to you."
"Have you got what you looked for?"
"I did not look for any specific thing. I only hoped to find, and find I have, all that there was. Only some letters and a few memoranda, and a diary new begun. But I have them here, and we shall for the present say nothing of them. I shall see that poor lad Arthur tomorrow evening, and with his sanction, I shall use some. And now, friend John, I think we may to bed. We want sleep, both you and I, and rest to recuperate. Tomorrow, we shall have much to do. But for the tonight, there is no need of us."
Before turning in, we went to look at poor Lucy. The undertaker had certainly done his work well, for the room was turned into a small chapelle ardente. There was a wilderness of beautiful white flowers, and death was made as little repulsive as might be. The end of the winding sheet was laid over the face. The professor bent over and turned it gently back. We both started at the beauty before us, the tall wax candle showing a sufficient light to note it well. All Lucy's loveliness had come back to her in death, and the hours that had passed, instead of leaving traces of decay's effacing fingers, had instead restored the beauty of life, till positively I could not believe my eyes that I was looking at a corpse.
"Yes, yes, it is as I expected."
He took from his neck inside his collar a little gold crucifix and placed it over the mouth.
"She may yet be saved."
"What do you mean?"
"Tomorrow, I want you to bring me, before night, a set of post-mortem knives."
"Must we make an autopsy?"
"Yes and no. I want to operate, but not as you think. Let me tell you now, but not a word to another. I want to cut off her head and take out her heart."
"Heaven's name!"
"Ah, you, a surgeon, and so shocked!
Fear not, for it is I that shall operate, and you must only help. I would like to do it tonight, but Arthur will arrive tomorrow, and he will want to see her. To see it. After all farewells are said, when she is coffined and ready for the next day, you and I shall come when all sleep. We shall unscrew the coffin lid and shall do our operation and then replace all so that none know save we alone."
"But why do it at all? The girl is dead. Why mutilate her poor body without need? There is no necessity for a post-mortem and nothing to gain by it. No good to her, to us, to science, to human knowledge. Without such need, it is monstrous."
"Friend John, I pity your poor bleeding heart,
and I love you the more because it does so bleed. If I could, I would take on myself the burden that you do bear. But there are things that you know not, but that you shall know, and bless me for knowing, though they are not pleasant things. Were you not amazed, nay, horrified, when I would not let Arthur kiss his love, though she was dying, and snatched him away by all my strength? Yes, and yet you saw how she thanked me with her so beautiful dying eyes, her voice too so weak, and she kissed my rough old hand and blessed me. And did you not hear me swear promise to her that so she closed her eyes grateful?
I do recall.
Well, but I have good reason now for all I want to do. You have for many years trusted me. You have believed me these weeks past, when there be things so strange that you might have well doubt. Friend John, there are strange and terrible days before us. Let us not be two, but one, that so we work to a good end. Will you not have faith in me?
I do acquiesce, with reservations.
It is enough.
I held my door open as he went away and watched him go into his room and close the door. As I stood without moving, I saw one of the maids pass silently along the passage, and she had her back towards me, so did not see me, and go into the room where Lucy lay. The sight touched me. Devotion is so rare, and we are so grateful to those who show it, unasked to those we love. I must have slept long and soundly, for it was broad daylight when Van Helsing waked me by coming into my room. He came over to my bedside and said,
"You need not trouble about the knives. We shall not do it."
"Why not?"
"Because it is too late, or too early. See, this was stolen in the night."
"Your gold crucifix? How is it stolen, since you have it now?"
"Because I get it back from the worthless wretch who did steal it, back from the woman who robbed the dead and the living. Now we can only wait."
"Wait? Wait for what?"
"For the beginning to end, and the end to begin."
"Dr. Van Helsing, each day you leave me more puzzled."
"In time, my friend, all in time. There are many pieces to the puzzle, eh? For now, you will prepare for the arrival of the young man, Arthur. And I must write to a young lady. Do you have the acquaintance of Mrs. Mina Harker, or rather, Miss Mina Murray?"
"Why, yes. I believe her to be a dear friend of Lucy's. Is Mina a part of this?"
"It is so. And also her new husband, Mr. Jonathan Harker."
"I fear I shall never follow your reasoning."
"Fear? You speak of fear? Watch. Listen. Learn. When truly you do understand, then you will know fear."
Early the next day, Arthur Holmwood arrived. Poor fellow. He looked desperately sad and broken. Even his stalwart manhood seemed to have shrunk somewhat under the strain of his much-tried emotions. With me, he was as warm as ever, and to Van Helsing he was courteous. But I could not help seeing that there was some constraint with him. The professor noticed it too, and motioned me to bring him upstairs. I did so, and left him at the door of the room, as I felt he would like to be quite alone with her. But he took my arm and led me in, saying,
"You loved her too, old fellow. She told me all about it. There was no friend had a closer place in her heart than you. I don't know how to thank you for all you've done for her."
"I only wish I could have done more."
"Oh, Jack, what shall I do? The whole of life seems gone from me all at once, and there is nothing in the wide world for me to live for."
"Come and look at her."
"Jack, is she really dead?"
"It is so, Arthur. It often happens that after death, faces become softened and even resolved into their youthful beauty. especially so when death is preceded by such acute and prolonged suffering.
I see.
This must be goodbye.
Yes. Yes, I understand. May I kiss her farewell?
Well, yes, I suppose it would be all right. He took her dead hand in his and kissed it. With a feeling of anticipation for which I cannot account, I watched as he bent over and kissed her lips. Finally, he came away, fondly looking back over his shoulder at her. I left him in the drawing room and went to the study where I found Van Helsing. He asked if she were really dead.
I am not surprised. Just now, I doubted for a moment myself.
Hello, Dr. Van Helsing.
Ah, young Arthur. Come in, come in. You have seen her and said your heart's farewell.
Yes, thank you. And let me say that I am at a loss for words to thank you for your goodness to my poor dear. I know that she understood your goodness even better than I do. And if I have been rude or in any way wanting, you must forgive me.
I know it has been hard for you to quite trust me. And I take it that you do not, that you cannot trust me now, for you do not yet understand. But the time will come when your trust shall be whole and complete, and then you shall understand as though the sunlight himself shone through.
But, Doctor, I do trust you. I shall and always trust you. I know and believe you have a very noble heart, and you are Jack's friend, and you were hers.
May I ask you something now?
Certainly.
You know that Mrs. Westenray left you all her property.
Lucy's mother?
All property. All letters of both Mrs. Westenray and Miss Lucy.
I never thought of it.
And as it is all yours, you have a right to deal with it as you will. I want you to give me permission to read all Miss Lucy's papers and letters. Believe me, it is no idle curiosity. I have a motive of which, be sure, she would have approved. I have them all here. I took them before we knew that all was yours, so that no strange hand might touch them, no strange eye look through words into her soul. I shall keep them, if I may. Even you may not see them yet, but I shall keep them safe. No word shall be lost, and in the good time, I shall give them back to you. It's a hard thing, I ask, but you will do it, will you not? For Lucy's sake.
Dr. Van Helsing, you may do what you will. I feel that in saying this, I am doing what my dear one would have approved. I shall not trouble you with questions till the time comes.
And you are right. There will be pain for us all, but it will not be all pain. Nor will this pain be the last. But we must be brave of heart and unselfish and do our duty. And all will be well.
In the train to Exeter, Jonathan sleeping. It seems only yesterday that the last entry was made, and yet how much has come to pass between then. In Whitby and all the world before me, Jonathan away and no news of him, and now married to Jonathan, Jonathan a solicitor, now a partner, master of his business. Mr. Hawkins is dead and buried. A very simple and solemn service. There were only ourselves and the servants there. One or two old friends of his from Exeter, his London agent, and a gentleman representing Sir John Paxton, the president of the Incorporated Law Society. Jonathan and I stood hand in hand, and we felt that our best and dearest friend was gone from us. We came back to town quietly, taking a bus to Hyde Park Corner, and then a walk down to Piccadilly. Jonathan was holding me when I felt him clutch my arm so tightly that he hurt me, and he said under his breath,
"My God!
What is it?" I followed his gaze to a tall, thin man with a beaky nose and black mustache and pointed beard, who was observing a very pretty girl. He was looking at her so hard that he did not notice either of us. And so I had a good view of him. His face was not a good face. It was hard and cruel and sensual. And his big white teeth, that looked all the whiter because his lips were so red, were pointed like an animal's. Jonathan, please, the man will notice your stare.
Do you not see who it is?
No, dear. I do not know him. Who is it?
It is the man himself.
The poor dear was evidently terrified at something, very greatly terrified. He kept staring as a man came out of a chemist's shop with a small parcel and gave it to the lady, who then drove off. The dark man kept his eyes fixed on her, and when the carriage moved up Piccadilly, he followed in the same direction and hailed a hansom. Jonathan kept looking after him and said as if to himself,
I believe it is the Count, but he has grown so young. My God, if this be so. Oh, my God. Oh, if I only knew. If I only knew.
I remained silent and drew him away quietly, and he, holding my arm, came easily. We walked a little further and then went in and sat for a while in the Green Park. It was a hot day for autumn, and there was a comfortable seat in a shady place. After a few minutes, staring at nothing, Jonathan's eyes closed, and he went quietly into a sleep, with his head on my shoulder. I thought it was the best thing for him, so did not disturb him. In about 20 minutes he woke up and said to me quite cheerfully,
Why, Mina, have I been asleep? Oh, do forgive me for being so rude. Come, we'll have a cup of tea somewhere.
He had evidently forgotten all about the dark stranger, as in his illness he had forgotten all that this episode had reminded him of. I must somehow learn the facts of his journey abroad. The time is come, I fear, when I must open that parcel and know what is written in the journal. Oh, Jonathan, you will, I know, forgive me if I do wrong, but it is for your own dear sake. Later the same day, I received a telegram from a Dr. Van Helsing, whoever he may be.
You will be grieved to hear that Mrs. Westenray died 5 days ago, and that Lucy died the day before yesterday. They were both buried today. I must speak with you at the earliest opportunity regarding these matters, and also the recent travels of your husband. With deep sympathy and all respect, Van Helsing.
Oh, what a wealth of sorrow in a few words. Poor Mrs. Westenray. Poor Lucy. Gone. Gone, never to return to us. God, help us all to bear our troubles. And now this request from Van Helsing about Jonathan. I have answered the doctor and asked him to come by the 10:15 train on the 25th.
Mrs. Harker?
Dr. Van Helsing.
I am Van Helsing.
Here, this is for you.
And what may this be?
It is a copy of the record my husband kept of his journey to Transylvania and his visit to Count Dracula.
You know of this man?
I do not know what I know. I do not know what I believe. I have taken the liberty of reading Jonathan's journal. I have also received correspondence from John Seward hinting at some terrible business at hand, and that I must trust you explicitly.
Hmm. Perhaps there is hope for our young friend after all.
Be that as it may, Doctor, I only ask that you read this manuscript, and if you can, refute or confirm this record. While Dr. Van Helsing read the manuscript, I prepared a simple lunch for the two of us. He had finished reading before we sat at the table, but would say nothing of the matter. Of course, I pressed, but he was firm. After lunch, we returned to the sitting room, and Van Helsing, after making himself comfortable, turned to me.
Dear Madam Mina, you may sleep without doubt. Strange and terrible as it is true. I will pledge my life on it. Your Jonathan is a noble fellow, and let me tell you from experience of men that one who would do as he did in going down that wall into that room is not one to be injured in permanence by a shock. His brain and his heart are all right. This I swear before I have even seen him. So be at rest. I have much to ask him. Will you bring him to me?
No.
We have little time. This count, this monster, is indeed in London.
You wish to see me, sir?
You will sit.
And?
Mr. Harker, you are in doubt of your own mind, yes?
How do you mean?
You may rest your mind. It is all true.
All of it?
All of it.
The brides?
The brides, the dogs, the wolves, the flames, the castle, the gypsies, the heaps of gold, the boxes of rotting earth. All true. All of it.
Cured me already. I was in doubt, and everything took a hue of unreality. I did not know what to trust, even the evidence of my own senses. Not knowing what to trust, I did not know what to do, and so had only to keep on working in what had hitherto been the groove of my life. The groove ceased to avail me, and I mistrusted myself. Doctor, you do not know what it is to doubt everything, even yourself. No, you don't. You couldn't with eyebrows like yours.
So, you are a physiognomist. I learn more here with each hour. And, my friend, you will pardon praise from an old man, but you are blessed in your wife. She is one of God's women, fashioned by his own hand to show us men and other women that there is a heaven where we can enter, and that its light can be here on earth. So true, so sweet, so noble, so little an egoist. And that, let me tell you, is much in this so skeptical and selfish an age. And now I have a great task to do. And at the beginning, it is to know. You can help me now. Will you join me?
Does what you do concern the Count?
It does.
Then I am with you heart and soul.
Good. Now we are six. Myself, Madame Mina, Mr. Jonathan, my good friend John Seward, Sir Arthur, and Quincy, the brave American. Together, we shall prevail, huh?
Van Helsing's glance fell to the London papers laid about the table.
Mein Gott! Mein Gott, so soon!
Dr. Van Helsing, are you all right?
I must go at once. There is much information which I need draw from you, Jonathan. And you, dear lady. Will you be ready when I should need?
We shall await your call.
And with scarcely a goodbye, Van Helsing was gone.
I wonder what it was that took him away so quickly.
I'm sure I cannot say.
Here, Mina, what do you make of this in the Gazette? The Hampstead Horror. Another child injured. We have just received intelligence that another child missed last night.
Missed last night? Was only discovered late in the morning under a furze bush at the Shooter's Hill side of Hampstead Heath, which is, perhaps, less frequented than the other parts. It has the same tiny wound in the throat as has been noticed in other cases. It was terribly weak and looked quite emaciated. It, too, when partially restored, had the common story to tell of being lured away by the Bloofer Lady. What say you to this, friend John?
You are referring to the small punctures, no doubt.
Ah, you are my favorite pupil still. It is worth to teach you. Now that you are willing to understand, you have taken the first step to understand. You think then that those so small holes in the children's throats were made by the same that made the holes in Miss Lucy?
I suppose so.
Then you are wrong. Oh, would it were so. But alas, no. It is worse. Far, far worse.
In God's name, Professor Van Helsing, what do you mean?
They were made by Miss Lucy.